From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, Uzo Aduba. She stars in the HBO series In Treatment as a Psychotherapist. That's a big switch from her performance in the women's prison series Orange is the New Black, in which she portrayed Suzanne Crazy Eyes Warren, an inmate with mental health problems. For that role, she won 2 Emmys. She won a 3rd for her portrayal of Shirley Chisholm in the series Mrs. America about the failed attempt to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment in the early 70s. Also, we hear from the comedy duo Desus and Mero, hosts of their own Showtime series. They'll discuss how graffiti, hip-hop, and jobs like collecting dead rats have figured into their lives. And Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Chrissy Hynde singing Dylan songs and Shannon McNally doing songs associated with Waylon Jennings.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I am constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Our first guest, Uzo Aduba, stars in the HBO series In Treatment as a psychotherapist. She's won Emmys in both the comedy and drama categories for her performance in the Netflix women's prison series Orange is the New Black. She played Suzanne Warren, who was nicknamed Crazy Eyes because of how she widens her big round eyes, reflecting the intensity and unpredictability caused by her mental health problems. Aduba won a 3rd Emmy for her performance in the FX series Mrs. America about the failed attempt to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s. Aduba portrayed Shirley Chisholm, who in 1968 became the first black woman elected to Congress, and in 1972, the first black person to run in a major party presidential primary. In the NBC Live production of The Wiz, Aduba played Glinda the Good Witch. Aduba is the daughter of Nigerian immigrants who came to America in the late 60s after the Biafran War. Aduba spoke with Terry Gross, and they started by talking about In Treatment. This season is a reboot of HBO's In Treatment that ended a decade ago and starred Gabriel Byrne as the therapist. The series now focuses on Aduba's character, Dr. Brooke Taylor. Here's a scene from a session with her patient Eladio, played by Anthony Ramos. He's been working as a live-in home health care aide for a wealthy family, taking care of their son Jeremy, who has a disability. Although Jeremy's parents are paying for Eladio's sessions with Dr. Taylor, hoping she can help cure his insomnia, Eladio thinks the family doesn't care about him. But he has no alternative, nowhere else to go. He's angry with the family and angry with himself and doesn't want to talk about it anymore.
If you want to talk about whatever, right? From now on, you want to talk about whatever. You want to talk about my mom, my f***ing ex, I'm down. But do me a favor and let's just put an embargo on this particular topic, okay? With all due respect.
That's a lot of anger, Eladio. A lot of justifiable anger. You have a right to your feelings, all of them. And I hear you. Do you know that I hear you? Look. We're not going to solve white people today. We're not going to solve capitalism today. But we can talk about the situation that stirs these feelings up in you.
Uzo Aduba, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Did playing a therapist lead to a lot of self-reflection? Did you start asking yourself questions that she asked her patients?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think the first thing is, why do people go to therapy? What are you supposed to do in therapy? I think that's a question anybody, myself included, who's ever gone to therapy wonders, you know, what am I initially supposed to be doing here with you? And you realize what you're supposed to be doing is being honest, both with the person in the room, but most important, yourself and what it is you're here to unpack.
So you've been in therapy yourself?
Yes.
Was it helpful in playing the character of a psychotherapist?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I certainly was able to tap into what the room and the structure of the experience is like having been in therapy. It was interesting for me being in Brooke's seat. It really made me empathic to not only my own therapist, but to therapists at large, that they do this all day. You know, the weight of that job is a heavy one. Because I think before, even though I knew that it was a hard job, I think I never really took full stock of what it must mean to have not just me come in for a session, but the person before me, the person after me, that they are responsible for helping to hold some of whatever it is that their patient brings in to the room that day, along with carrying whatever it is they're holding in their own lives.
And it doesn't stop. It's like one person's pain after another person's pain that you have to comprehend and respond to. And that just feels like a lot. I think about that a lot. You know, I've been seeing a therapist for years and find it like so valuable. But I often think about, well, gee, what is it like for her to just hear all of us?
Absolutely. And I mean, also it made me wonder, we don't know what they're going through in their own lives and mm-hmm. how much of whatever it is that you're bringing into the room echoes what they're going through. And it's just a hard job and it's not an easy one. I have such respect for a deepened respect for therapists and their every day, you know, what they're tasked with dealing with every day.
So my next question is going to relate to your mother. And I want to start before I ask you a question by saying, I know you lost your mother in November and I just want to say how sorry I am. So
thank you.
Yeah. Your mother was from Nigeria and she was a social worker. Yeah. How did she feel about therapy? Did she encourage therapy or feel that there was a stigma about it? I don't know what it was like in Nigeria, whether there was much psychotherapy there and how it was regarded.
You know, I don't know how it was regarded growing up for her as a young person before moving to the United States. My mother was a social worker and she thought therapy was a fine resource. She supported it. She thought it was great. She believed in it. I think probably coming from her professional background, she understood it in a larger way. My mom also came from a house of people who talked. She grew up in a very progressive home who really did talk and communicate and engage with each other. So I'm sure that served as a bit of a launching pad for her to be also progressive about therapy for her children. You know, my mom was a bit of a therapist herself in certain ways, you know, whether it was for her children or nieces and nephews or neighbors and friends. She had a very confiding spirit in her. You know, everybody used to call her the vault because you could tell her something, she's never going to repeat it. You know, she's never going to repeat it. And it wasn't uncommon to come home and see people, you know, either standing in the driveway with her talking or pulled over in a corner on a couch somewhere talking to her. And, you know, they were having something intimate there discussed. And she would never break that trust ever. And, yeah, she was amazing, an amazing, 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 amazing place to take solace and comfort.
In the series, we get to see what you're like as a therapist when you're usually like very calm and very reflective. But we also get to see you in your private life after you started right. drinking again, when you're kind of like a different person. It's an interesting role for an actor to have because it's almost as if you're playing two parts. But, you know, we can see that as a therapist, you're so perceptive about other people's rationalizations and delusions. But you've been going through a lot. Your father had recently died. The character's father had recently died. And you miss him, but you're also really still angry with him. And you don't really see the things you're hiding from yourself. You don't see your own delusions. And that's where your AA sponsor, Rita, comes in. She realizes, after coming back from a trip, that you've been drinking again after years of sobriety. She calls you out on it. And I want to play a scene where she's talking to you about drinking again. And Rita is played by Liza Colon Zayas. She speaks first.
So,
When did it start? Again.
Around when my father died.
And did Adam have anything to do with this?
Don't blame him. I'm a grown-ass woman.
Why couldn't you call me when you had your head on straight?
My head hasn't been on straight for a while now. Besides, I knew whatever you were going to say wouldn't change my mind.
Now, I've talked you down before.
Yeah, well, this isn't before.
How are you treating patients like this?
I would never compromise my work.
No, I'm not saying that. It's just if it were me.
I know how to hold my patients' pain. I show up for them. They come in here into this house carrying their fear and despair and anxiety because they have nowhere else to turn. I am here for them.
And who holds your pain? Where do you leave your despair at the bottom of one of these bottles?
I just want to forget it all sometimes. It's not that complicated to understand. Sometimes I want to silence that voice that makes me feel small. You know, could I do some positive self-talk, some CBT, some meditation? Sure. But sometimes an old-fashioned or four just gets me there a little bit faster.
That's my guest, Uzo Aduba, in a scene from In Treatment. Do you feel like you really understand how someone can be so perceptive about other people's behavior and motivations and so blind to their own?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, I think they call that life.
Yeah, yeah. The strange part about the casting is that you're probably most famous for your role as Suzanne Warren, a.k.a. Crazy Eyes, in Orange is the New Black, where your character had really serious mental health issues.
Yeah.
And so it's like, yeah, let's get that person to play the therapist.
Yeah. That's. I thought the same thing. I was like, well, if that's not a 180, I don't know what is. I'm just kind of like, what? I was like, did you read my resume? I was like, have you read it? it was exciting, though. That wasn't lost on me, to tell you the honest truth, you know? I was like, wow, this is so interesting, you know, being on the polar opposite, you know, in ways of one story. You know, it felt like I had played the funhouse mirror side of mental health, and now being on the opposite end with Dr. Brooke Taylor providing another set of challenges. But it was great. It was great to have had that experience with Suzanne, Crazy Eyes Warren, and now coming into this project.
Uzo Aduba speaking with Terry Gross. Aduba stars in the HBO series In Treatment. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break, and Ken Tucker will review new albums by Chrissy Hynde singing Dylan songs and Shannon McNally doing songs associated with Waylon Jennings. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Uzo Aduba. She stars in the HBO series In Treatment as a psychotherapist, Dr. Brooke Taylor. Aduba won 2 Emmys for her performance in Orange is the New Black as Suzanne Warren, a.k.a. Crazy Eyes, and won a 3rd Emmy for her portrayal of Shirley Chisholm in the series Mrs. America. Aduba is the daughter of Nigerian immigrants and grew up in Medfield, Massachusetts.
I want to ask you about Orange is the New Black, since that was really the role that TV viewers got to know you from. And you play Suzanne Warren, who's known by the nickname Crazy Eyes because she has mental health problems. She has no boundaries. She has no understanding of how to interact with other people. And she's impulsive and often out of control and can be scary even when she's expressing her love for you. And I want to play a scene. Your character has been infatuated with one of the other inmates, Piper Chapman. And in this scene from the first season, You're explaining how you're sometimes sent to the psych ward in prison and how you've also been in the SHU, which is the acronym for the Solitary Housing Unit, which is basically solitary confinement. And so Taylor Schilling as Piper Chapman speaks first.
Is psych worse than the SHU?
Way worse. Scary. Bold. Cold. Old. It's real bad. I wouldn't wish it on the worst gremlin.
But they give you a therapist?
No. Nope. They give me medication to make me calm, but that just makes me sleepy. Sometimes when I'm real upset, they tie me down like a balloon so I don't fly away.
That sounds horrible.
And nobody comes back from psych to me. Once you go to psych, you get lost in psych. It's like that place with the three corners and the ocean.
The Bermuda Triangle.
We should play charades sometime, Dandelion. We can make great partners. Not wives. Just partners.
Oh, can I ask you one more question? Yeah, of course.
How come everyone calls me Crazy Eyes?
Uzo Aduba, what was your take on the character, and what did you model her on?
My take on the character was that she was just looking for love in all the wrong places.
In all the wrong ways.
And in all the wrong ways. She actually was born of my imagination. It was a line in the script that described her as something like innocent, like a child, except children aren't scary. And I remember it just popped an image in my head of like a kid with a sledgehammer in their head, like this sort of unintentionally destructive, you know. But I thought she was just so honest, so loving, and she just saw the world differently than we did. That was always how I just approached her.
So you were an athlete when you were growing up. You were a figure skater, competitive figure skater. You ran track. What was your relationship to your body then? Did you feel like it was really strong and capable and could do things other bodies couldn't?
I think it was a mix. I knew and felt that my body was strong and capable, and I thought it was beautiful and all of this. But remembering also the time that we're talking about, I don't think those were always things that were celebrated necessarily for girls.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you think is beautiful often and is strong and is an attribute, you know, a strong, beautiful characteristic, I should say, it's starts to become challenged when that's not something that's being, when something different is being lifted up, let me say it that way.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the 80s and 90s here, and so people think, like, you're not feminine enough?
Oh, yeah, not feminine enough, not slim enough, fair enough, too muscular, not beautiful enough. I mean, you name it.
How did being Black figure into the not beautiful enough?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think certainly, you know, I don't hold any proximity whatsoever to Eurocentric beauty.
But did you grow up in a community with a lot of white people?
Yes, I grew up, yes, very much so. My family was maybe one of three Black families by the time I started school. And yeah, you know, the idea, an ideal beauty, not just what I'm observing, but told, spoken on, was blonde hair, blue eyes, or brown hair, brown eyes. And I have neither, so then you start to think, oh, okay, then I guess the antithesis of that must be ugly.
Did you feel ugly?
At times, yeah.
I did. I did not think I was, but I started to feel like I must be.
Was your mother helpful in helping you overcome that?
Yes, later down the road. I think, you know, things that, like, for example, I used to hate my gap as a kid.
In your front teeth?
In my front teeth. I have a gap. And I would beg for braces because everybody had braces. Everybody was fixing their horrible teeth, you know, whatever that means. And my mom would, she was just like, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And, you know, finally she sat me down. I was begging. She said, what you have there is anyaku gap also. She said, don't you know that in Nigeria and throughout Africa, a gap is a sign of beauty. Why would you want to close it? And I was like, sure, but we live in America. we don't live in, you know, and she would impress those kind of things on me. And because I wouldn't smile in pictures, you know, I would just like, I'd be laughing, but then like, as soon as we would take a picture, I'd close, smile with my mouth closed. And my mom would be like, open your mouth, smile. You have such a beautiful smile. And I never would. And it wasn't until my senior year of high school, I was doing my yearbook pictures. We're in the library taking our pictures and the photographer is talking to me and, you know, he's chatting me up and we're talking and I'm laughing. And then as soon as he points the camera, I close my mouth and I'm not smiling. And he says to me finally, he's like, how come you're not smiling in pictures? And I was like, I don't know. I don't like my smile. And he's like, why not? And I was like, I don't like my gap. And then he paused for a minute and he says, you know, I think you have a beautiful smile. And I remember thinking to myself, like, what? You know, like, It's like, just like kind of blown away. And even though my mom has said this for thousands of years at this point, and by the way, she always hated when I tell this story because she was like, so you listened to that man, but you didn't listen to me, you know, like, But it stuck with me, and I didn't necessarily smile that day, Terry, in the picture, but I did end up smiling the rest of that year, and have since, in photographs. You know, I made a point. I was like, every time I would take a picture, senior year, I'd say, I have a beautiful smile, and do a big cheese smile. And yeah, it made an impact, and she impacted my life in ways because she had been reinforced. She was really insistent, my mom, in making sure that we saw ourselves for who we actually are versus what the world might want to tell us we are. And it was hugely powerful and had a great deal of effect on my life. And I think maybe not as strongly in my younger years, but I think it has absolutely cemented in me my identity, what I will and will not allow as the definition of for who I am, and has certainly made me feel very strongly in just myself, in my feet, walk in my body. You know, it's not perfect, but walk in with a confidence of, no, I know who I am.
Well, I wish you all good things, and it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. I really want to thank you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
Uzo Aduba stars in the HBO series In Treatment. Two women have recently released albums covering songs made famous by two men. The first is called Standing in the Doorway. Chrissy Hynde sings Bob Dylan. The other is The Waylon Sessions, in which Shannon McNally sings songs associated with country singer Waylon Jennings. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that in very different ways, McNally and Hynde, the lead singer of The Pretenders, are finding new things in old songs.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals of violence. doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true like ice, like fire.
Standing in the doorway, subtitled Chrissy Hynde Sings Bob Dylan, is a lockdown project, one of those rare gifts of art in the wake of the pandemic. Chrissy Hynde says she and Pretenders bandmate James Walborn, separated at the height of COVID, recorded the songs by exchanging messages over their phones, and the collaborations were later mixed by producer Chad Blake.
I was in your presence for an hour or so. What was it a day? I truly don't know. The sun never set and the trees are low by the soft and shining sea. Do you respect me for what I did or what I didn't do or keeping it hid? Did I lose my mind when I try to get rid of everything you see? In the summertime, whoa, in the summertime, in the summertime.
That's In the Summertime from Dylan's 1981 album, Shot of Love. There doesn't seem to be any guiding theme or framework to Hynde's song choices, which tend toward lesser-known work. But there's no superfan obscurity or hipper-than-thou grandstanding, and there isn't a false note on this entire album.
Well, just a minute before you leave. Just a minute before you touch the door. What is it that you're trying to achieve? Do you think we could just talk about it some more? The streets are filled with vipers who've lost all ray of hope. It ain't even safe no more in the palace of the Pope. Oh, don't fall apart on me tonight. I just don't think that I could handle it. But don't fall.
Hynde sings every song as though she's telling you about experiences she's had. The dry bitterness that can overwhelm some of these compositions when Dylan performs them ripens into a more lush atmosphere here. The deeply beautiful 7 minutes Chrissy Hynde spends singing Standing in the Doorway seem to tell the story of a woman's entire life.
I'm walking through the summer nights, the jukebox playing low. Yesterday, everything was going too fast. Today, it's moving too slow. I got no place left to turn. I got nothing left to burn. Don't know if I saw you, if I would kiss you or kill you. It probably wouldn't matter to you anyhow. You left me standing in the doorway crying. I got nothing to go back.
Waylon Jennings' body of work would seem to be one of the least likely inspirations for a woman to seize upon. Jennings spent his career pursuing an outlaw romantic ideal that demonstrated little comprehension of female wants and desires. Yet Shannon McNally has recorded an album that rearranges the molecules of Jennings' music, turning his tales of cowboy machismo into the stark declarations of a woman taking control of her life.
This time, if you want me to come back, it's up to you. But remember, I won't allow the things you used to do. Gonna have to toe the mark and walk the line. This time will be the last time. This time.
That's Shannon McNally setting firm boundaries before she'll take back a lover who's treated her badly in the past. McNally isn't, strictly speaking, a country singer. She's also recorded an album covering the songs of the New Orleans pop writer Bobby Charles, and she resides at the arty end of the country neighborhood, sometimes working with that ultimate art country auteur Terry Allen and his Panhandle Mystery Band. Here's McNally doing Black Rose, a Billy Joe Shaver song whose best recording, until now, was done by Jennings.
Way down in Virginia, among the tall grown sugar canes, lived a simple man and a Dominica hen and the rose of a different name. Well, the first time I felt lacking, I was standing in the drizzling rain. I had a trembling hand and a bottle of gin and a rose of a different name. Well, the devil made me do it the first time. The second time I've done it on my own. Lord, put a handle on a simple-headed gal. Help me leave that black rose alone.
Like Chrissie Hynde, McNally doesn't take on the prickly persona of the man who first recorded these songs. They both used the structures the men built to create their own, in some cases, far more complex, rich, emotional spaces.
Ken Tucker reviewed Standing in the Doorway, Chrissie Hynde sings Bob Dylan, and Shannon McNally's album, The Waylon Sessions. Coming up, we hear from Desus and Mero, hosts of the Showtime comedy series Desus and Mero. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Hotwire. Imagine a nice vacation. Is there a view of the parking lot? No. So don't book a cheap hotel. Book an expensive hotel for cheap on Hotwire. You can stay in a nicer hotel than you ever thought possible. Just select your city, neighborhood, and amenities, then get your hot rate. Better views, king-size beds, and freshly pressed waffle-woven robes await you. And also actual waffles. Download the Hotwire app now and book beyond your wildest means. All bookings final.
Our next guests, Desus and Mero, host the Showtime comedy series, Desus and Mero, Sunday and Thursday nights at 11. At the heart of the show is Desus and Mero talking to each other, making each other and the audience laugh about everything from politics to viral videos, sports, pop culture, and the Bronx, where they each grew up in the 80s and early 90s. The show also has sketches, and in each show, Desus and Mero do an interview. They get high-profile guests like Barack Obama, Anthony Fauci, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Chadwick Boseman, Seth Meyers, and Chris Hayes, who went to school with Desus. Desus and Mero are the children of immigrants. Desus' parents are from Jamaica. Mero's are from the Dominican Republic. They wrote about that in their best-selling book, God-Level Knowledge Darts, Life Lessons from the Bronx, in which they give questionable but funny advice about drugs, parenting, masculinity, dealing with police, and surviving while broke. The duo started doing comedy together on Twitter, then created a podcast called Bodega Boys, which led to a TV show on Viceland and then a TV show on Showtime. Terry spoke to Desus and Mero in June.
Desus and Mero, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thanks for having us.
So before you started working together, you both had a bunch of jobs before becoming like TV and audio people. So you had like legal, illegal, semi-legal kind of jobs. Tell us about some of the most interesting. Desus, you want to start?
Oh, yeah, I've had a million jobs, but I think one of the most interesting jobs I had was working at the New York Public Library, because I worked there. Every job I've had, I've pretty much worked my way through the ranks. And so I started as a computer page at the library, and I worked my way all the way up to, I was almost a programmer for the New York Public Library in just a matter of years. Just looking back at that, that was just wild, because I was like, okay, maybe this could be like my job for the rest of my life. Because, you know, thinking back in the day, like people would have a job for 20 years with one company, but it didn't work out that way. And, you know, that was like one of the better jobs, because I've had terrible jobs. At one job, I had to collect dead rats at an auto body shop.
Whoa, I've never heard of such a job. Like a professional rat catcher.
Yeah, if you want to say professional, if you mean like a 15-year-old with Vicks Vapor Rub on his top lip, that's what, because the person came the week before and they put down a bait, but no one stopped to think, okay, they're going to eat the bait and die, and now there's going to be this terrible smell inside the building. And in key to the story, New York was in the middle of a heat wave, so it was about 100 degrees every day that I was working. And the only skill I had was use my nose to smell the dead rat, which was usually under a car or like behind something, use the shovel to scoop up the dead rat, and you put it into a compound bucket, and then you dump the compound bucket into the barrel of used oil from oil changes that got picked up at the end of the week. I lasted 2 weeks at that job.
Wow. Didn't you also work managing a strip club?
I did. See, that's how wild my life is. That's not even like a job I think over the top of my head. I'm like, oh yeah, that's something I did. But we are working in different nightclubs all over New York City, working in strip clubs. That sounds like a lot more fun than it is. It's a lot of clock watching, a lot of dealing with people's personal lives like outside the club so they can come to work. It takes a lot of skill. And the only reason I got that job was because I was at a club and they were discussing the velvet ropes in front of the club. And they didn't know the name of the poles that the velvet ropes go on. And I said, you mean a stanchion? And it was like, what? And I was like, that's called a stanchion. And it was like, do you know how to use computers? And I was like, yes. And from there you go, working in a nightclub.
Wow. Mira, let's get to some of your jobs.
Oh, man. I've had every retail job you could imagine. Like, I worked at Sally Beauty Supply. I worked at an Ann Taylor Loft. I worked at, like...
Wait, you worked at an Ann Taylor Loft?
Yeah, seriously. And I was in the stock room, but going back to, like, when did you know you were funny? Like, I would just make people on the crew laugh, you know what I mean? And people that my coworkers laugh or whatever. And one of the managers was... That was the first time somebody ever called me charismatic. He was just like, you're really charismatic. And I was just like, okay, that's weird. I haven't done my hair in 2 weeks and I have gold teeth. So I don't know how you find me charismatic. So then they had me on the floor, like interfacing with, like, you know, all kinds of people in Manhattan and just kind of like selling them blouses.
Oh, did you have to say that looks so adorable on you?
Yeah, like that, you know, that kind of thing. But like, I'm a Dominican guy, so like I'm very flirtatious by nature. So I sold a lot of blouses using, you know, flirting.
Uh-huh. Okay, what else? What other jobs?
Honestly, like, the two biggest ones for me were I worked at Lehman Brothers pre and post 9/11 and pre-collapse, and then working for the New York City Department of Education as a paraprofessional and teaching. Those were the two main ones for me. And, like, the Lehman Brothers one was just soul-crushing because it was just super corporate. And it was just really bad. Like, the hours sucked. Everything sucked. And it was just soul-crushing because I would see all these people, and I knew in my, like, you know, as a kid, I'd be like, you know, I'm never going to see even a quarter of the amount of money that you see. Like, you have 16 monitors in front of you, and you're talking about finance and stuff. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I just know that you will be rich forever, and I will be broke forever, and I'm going to be changing your water and bringing your mail until I perish.
You're both the children of immigrants, and Miro, your parents are from the Dominican Republic, and Desus, your parents are from Jamaica. Did they each tell you a lot about, like, their backstories and why they came to New York?
All the time. I think that's, like, the immigrant parent trope, is, like, they tell you constantly how much they struggled and sacrificed so that you could have a better life. And it's true. Like, now that I'm, you know, a 38-year-old man with four children myself, I understand exactly where they're coming from. When you're 10 years old, you kind of don't want to hear it. But as an adult, it's like, you know, that work ethic, that drive is instilled in you early. I can't even imagine. Like, my parents came here, you know, in their early 20s. It's like, yo, I'm going to, as a 20-something-year-old, imagine moving to a place where you don't know the language, you don't know the lay of the land, you don't know anybody there. You're just going there with a couple of bucks and trying to make it happen. And that just that idea is terrifying to me at 38. So I can't even imagine doing it at, like, you know, 22, 21. They're just built different. So, like, you know, to honor them and to kind of show, like, hey, look, you know, this was not in vain. Like, look at what we've accomplished, like, the three of us, because I have two siblings, you know, and they, all the three of us did what we set out to do, which is, you know, come here and be successful and then pay it forward, you know.
Yeah, my parents definitely, looking back, they weren't like, look, I did this to, like, berate me or anything. I think looking back, like, they were just trying to process it themselves to be that young with young children in a country you don't understand. That adds, like, a different level of stress I can't even imagine. And looking back, I just always remember my parents stressing about the idea that they came to this country to give me a chance so that I wouldn't just, you know, just squander it, because especially growing up in the Bronx, it wasn't that hard to like fall in with the wrong crowd, end up selling drugs or running around with guns and stuff like that. And that would have totally just been a waste of time for what my parents were trying to accomplish. And then also living where I lived at the time growing up, I lived in the northeastern part of the Bronx, which is affectionately referred to as Little Jamaica because it has a huge West Indian population and there's a lot of Jamaican stores and restaurants and supermarkets. So growing up, there was definitely a sense of community because everyone around me basically was Jamaican, to the point where until I got older and started exploring, I thought all of New York was like that. So it was kind of shocking to go to Manhattan. I'm like, hey, there's no beef patty stores down here. But, you know, definitely parents instilled that in that and always put that in me. So it was always in the back of my head. Also, that immigrant work ethic, that it's just like you have to work harder than other people, because not that you have more to prove, but you got more at stake. There's no plan B. There's no like safety net for you to fall on. And that, to this day, I continue doing that every day when we do work.
So you both grew up in the Bronx in the 1980s and 90s. And I mean, the Bronx was kind of like, during that period, it was kind of like the capital of graffiti and hip hop culture. Which parts of that were most important in your life?
I grew up in a household where, like, we didn't speak English. Like, I didn't speak English until I went to school. So hearing hip-hop and hearing the Jungle Brothers straight out of the jungle for the first time, like, blew my mind. Like, literal, like I was like, what is this? This is like, next level. This is the future or whatever. So, you know, shout out to my cousin Patty because I used to just, like, raid her like vinyl and like cassette collection or whatever and listen to all types of stuff. But graffiti, like I just, and to this day, like I'm just like obsessed. Like, I don't know if I can even explain it. It's just like it's an addiction that I'm not mad I have. Yeah, it's just like, it's so much fun. It's like an adrenaline rush. And then it's like putting your autograph somewhere and then you go and you see your autograph later on, you know what I mean? I don't know. I can't explain it to like a non-graffiti writer, but like it's like there's kind of like there's this rush where you see, like if I paint a one of those like white box trucks and I just see it, like I paint it in the Bronx and then I see it out somewhere on a highway in New Jersey, I'm like, yo, wow. You know what I mean? Like at least 15 to 20 people have seen my name rolling down the highway.
So did you learn English in part by listening to rap?
Definitely. Music, television, older cousins that were bilingual, but mostly like pop culture, TV, music, stuff like that. Like I learned a lot of stuff from Saved by the Bell.
But if you were learning English in part from rap, like you learned English in part in rhyme.
Yeah. And which is funny because like I'm always coming up with these weird like phrases or catchphrases or whatever, and I feel like that's kind of like what hip hop did to me. Like it made me think in like couplets, you know what I'm saying? Like whenever I'm writing or talking or whatever. But yeah, no, like that definitely influenced the way like I speak. Period.
What was your best way of hiding from police when you were doing graffiti?
All black outfit, you know, if it's summertime, black t-shirt, black pants, sweatpants, shorts, whatever, and nothing reflective, maybe a bandana, you know what I'm saying? But the best thing really is to just have a black plastic bag from a bodega full of paint and just walk down the street like you're minding your business. That's the thing. That's the best disguise is no disguise when you're doing graffiti.
Right. Desus, what were the parts of hip-hop and graffiti culture that you most identified with or were part of?
For me, it was more music, because my father, he was a DJ in Jamaica, and then when he came to America, he still had like a lot of vinyl and things like that. Because he had to work, he didn't really have time to DJ anymore. But I always like saw the records and saw like when he would play music or how exactly he would get when he'd have cookouts and barbecues, and like he'd like arrange the music a certain way. And because of that, like I was always listening to like old school Jamaican music, old school dancehall, which helped me, you know, when you start hearing those samples in KRS-One and different levels of hip hop. And then having so many sisters, they would always be playing hip hop. they'd always, my oldest sister would always play like Tribe Called Quest, whatever new albums came out. She'd be the way I'd find out about stuff because I was too young to go out on my own. And not only that, my sisters, they'd date guys and the guys would come around and they'd play brand new music from like their neighborhood. Like, so that's how I found out about like Heavy D and Pete Rock and all those people. So I was always growing up, that was always the vibe of New York City for me, like just trying to like move from basically one hip hop album to another. And shout out to my man G Steel, we used to actually go to vinyl stores. We'd cut school and just go, not just to buy new vinyl, but we'd go and we'd like what we call digging in the crates, where you just look through, because there's no turntable at the time, so you had to like kind of look for old records and judge them basically by their cover. And then when you go home, you listen to them. And we weren't producers at the time, but when something we really liked to do was find an old record and identify a sample. And so you'd buy these old albums and you'd just be listening to the, all these old tracks, and then you'd hear like a 30-second sample and you take it back. And this is way before the internet. This is before there was any like pop culture easy way for you to identify samples. And then you'd figure out, oh, DJ Premier sampled this track for this Nas song. And then, like, you know, I'd call my boy G and try to ride on my bike over to his house to play the record for him. And that's the kind of like hip hop nerd stuff we were doing back in the day.
Mary, you said that you realized you had to find a way, and I'm paraphrasing here, to turn hopelessness into comedy. Was that like a revelation you had? Or is that something you just naturally did?
Yeah, no, it was just natural. Because it was like, I had to laugh at the roaches in my apartment. I couldn't do anything about it. You know what I mean? I had to laugh at, like, you know, drinking water and going to bed because I didn't have anything to eat. I'm a broken record with this phrase, but it's just like the best art is honest art. And if you're being honest and you're telling the truth and you're being transparent about your background, who you are, where these jokes are coming from, what inspired these jokes, you know what I mean? I feel like it's gonna come out a lot easier and cleaner. It's not gonna be forced. So like, yeah, man, like I literally would turn on the light in my apartment and like do like Savion Glover tap dance all over the place to kill all these roaches. And no matter how much bleach I tossed all around the place, it didn't matter because I lived in a building where my neighbor was gross. So I had, by transitive property, I had roaches. You know what I mean? So things like that, like a cop spray painting brand new shoes, not getting arrested, like having cops just mess with you, that's like, it's deflating. You know, I'd rather you book me, you know what I mean? And like, at least I'll get like a sandwich.
Wait, so they'd spray paint your shoes?
Yeah, that happened to me a bunch of times. They'd spray paint my stuff, throw, you know.
Would they use your spray paint to do it?
Yeah.
But they'd do that instead of arresting you?
Yeah. They'd throw you up, put you in cuffs, spray your shoes, spray your shirt.
And then release you?
And then uncuff you and then be like, yo, get out of here, you piece of, you know, expletive.
And in retrospect?
In retrospect, I'm like, I don't know if that was better or worse than getting arrested because I got a pretty clean record, but I'm like, man, like that sucked. You know what I mean? Like how many pairs of shoes did I ruin, you know?
You talk about politics a lot on the show, both in your riffing with each other, but also with guests, with AOC, with Bernie Sanders, with lots of other people. You interviewed Obama, and it seemed to me like he knew your show. Are you ever doing your show and thinking, oh, Obama might be listening?
But it was something we always thought about in the past, but now it's just like, now you're just like, oh, Obama's listening? I'm going to definitely do this joke, because what's he going to do? He
has really?
Just,
yeah.
He has to sit there in the living room and take it, and Michelle's sitting there like, ah, you can't do anything about it, Barry. But no, it's like, that's the beauty of being on Showtime. You have a higher platform and just more people listening to you. And every now and then we'll do a joke and like a celebrity or someone we did the joke about, they'll come up and they'll be like, that joke was hilarious. And that's part of the growth of the platform, because it's just like knowing that you're doing jokes and that you're going to have to one day come across these people you're making jokes about. You have to do these jokes with your chest. You have to say them confidently, because the worst thing you want to do is have someone come up, run up on you like, yo, why'd you say this? And you got to be all like, oh, I didn't mean that. Da, 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 da. You know what I'm saying? Like, we've had that had in the past now, and since we've dealt with that, we're not ever going to have that happen again. So now, and most people are good sports about it. Most people, you get a text message like, oh, you cooked me, or oh, you roasted me on that. And people, they understand it's comedy. And at the end of the day, it's just jokes. And that's a good feeling.
Well, Desus and Mero, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Desus and Miro host the Showtime comedy series Desus and Miro. They spoke with Terry Gross. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our engineer this week is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, Kayla Lattimore, and Joel Wolfram. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.